The last investigator I met with was Dr. Dennis Slayman, and of course we talked a lot about what's new in anti-HER2 treatment. But to begin, I asked his views on current clinical research in the other 80% of breast cancer.
The HER2 field has become enormously crowded. There's a lot of therapeutics available, combinations, a lot of good strategies. But where we really do need some new therapies is an ER-positive disease that has escaped hormonal therapeutic approaches or was resistant out of the gate. And I think that given the fact that in most of the world, but specifically in the U.S. and Western Europe, ER-positive breast cancer constitutes 60 to 65% of breast cancer. This is a huge problem. And all of the therapeutic approaches we've tried, for the most part, to date, have been aimed at the estrogen or the estrogen receptor pathways, either decreasing the hormone levels or assaulting the receptor for the hormone. I think we're now starting to see data come out that when you look at some of the pathways that are non-direct ER pathways but may impact on that pathway, you can have an effect. Perhaps the most recent results of that are the Bolero 2 results that have come out with everolimus, showing that adding everolimus to an aromatase inhibitor gave a dramatic improvement in terms of the hazard ratios of around 0.36. That's pretty remarkable and a real step forward. The challenge is, of course, safety. There were a lot of patients who had mucositis from that drug. It's a known side effect. The people who've been working with it in kidney cancer have known about it for a while. So it's a matter of, I think, the breast oncologist trying to learn it and deal with it as well. But that's not the only pathway that perhaps is involved in hormone resistance. Certainly it's one, the PI3 kinase pathway, and everolimus hitting that indirectly. From some work we've been doing, we've found that the cyclin CDK pathway may also be operating in these cancers, and I think that's something that is exploitable. Certainly preclinical data told us it was worthwhile to look at, and the early clinical data in phase 1 and phase 2 looks very promising, with hazard ratios that are not dissimilar, but much smaller numbers of patients.
I guess another strategy has been to look at it in HER2-positive disease along with chemotrastuzumab.
So, you know, we've been involved largely doing preclinical to clinical translation. So we have a big preclinical lab that's linked to many of our clinical trials. And actually, it was early data with everolimus that showed that when we looked at a panel of breast cancer cell lines, the most effective activity we saw for everolimus was in the ER positives as well as the HER2 positives, both luminals. And that led to the strategy after phase 1 showed everolimus could be used in other diseases. That led to the strategy in breast to go after ER-positive disease, and that has been reported in Bolero 2. And Bolero 1 should report sometime this year a similar size study looking at HER2-positive breast cancers that have become resistant to HER2-targeted therapy. So we're all waiting for the results from that study as well.
You mentioned the mucositis. There's been pneumonitis seen. It's kind of hard, though, to get a feel for, you know, overall globally how much this impacts quality of life, particularly in a patient who maybe is going to be on hormone therapy. Are there a substantial number of patients you kind of cruise through it, or do most people have some problems?
Well, it depends on the definition of most. I mean, they're reporting, you know, incidences of grade 3-4, which everyone pays attention to. But remember, grade 2 mucositis can be really limiting for people who are working. Just like for some of the other drugs we've looked at, people talk about grade 2 diarrhea. Grade 2 diarrhea for a school teacher is certainly a limiting toxicity. And there's a lot more grade 2 than I think people realize with everolimus in terms of the mucositis. We're seeing somewhere around 20-25%, which is a, you know, reasonable number. The pneumonitis is less common, but is also a problem. But those two side effects become particularly problematic when you think about the possibility of moving this in upfront therapy if you have an ER-positive disease to prevent the development of resistance. And there the tolerability becomes a much bigger issue to deal with.
Now, the Bolero 2 trial that you talked about does look at patients who have progressed on an AI, anastrozole, or letrozole. Of course, it hasn't been approved at this point. If it is approved, I mean, it actually is available, obviously, for renal cell, how would you utilize it in your practice? Would you use it just the way the trial or maybe earlier?
Right now, I think the way to use it would be the way it was used in the trial. My concern about using it earlier is, of course, what we just talked about. We are seeing a lot of patients who develop mucositis. Now, Interceding early with steroid mouthwashes and stuff for the oral mucositis, I think, can ameliorate some of those symptoms. But it could be a real problem, and I think it may make it a challenge to use the drug a lot earlier. Perhaps dose adjusting might be another approach in terms of, do we really need the dose that was used? And would decreasing that decrease the mucositis? Because the patients did go through stage dose reductions if they had the mucositis. So I think there are a lot of strategies. But the exciting thing is the data from Bolero 2 showed that targeting something other than the ER pathway in ER-positive hormone-resistant disease could have some pretty profound effects. And that's got everybody excited about looking at other ways to use everolimus, as well as looking at other PI3 kinase pathway inhibitors.
And I guess we also have to talk about the possibility of looking at it in the adjuvant setting where these toxicity issues are going to be even greater. Do you see that happening in a trial setting?
Well, that's certainly the rate-limiting step, and it's what I alluded to earlier in the sense that I think that that's going to be a lot more challenging. Used as currently published in Bolero 2, be a lot more challenging to do that in the adjuvant setting. It would be wonderful to have a combination for ER-positive breast cancers that would stop the evolution of resistant disease for those patients that are going to have the development of resistant disease, as well as to treat those patients who are de novo resistant to hormonal manipulation. And so there are some numbers of those. So I think having a combination would be really exciting, but this drug, everolimus, at the way it was used in Bolero 2, I think would be challenging to do in the adjuvant setting.
So let's talk about HER2-positive disease. And before we get into all the excitement about the new agents and pertuzumab and T-DM1, got to ask you about the BCARG6 trial that got published in the New England Journal after quite a while, a few months ago. Anything you want to say about that paper and reactions to it?
Well, it was great to finally get it out. It went through a lot of challenges. I mean, the fact that we were advocating that perhaps you could consider a non-anthracycline regimen in human breast cancer was something that didn't always sit well with people. But I think the data were known and publicly available to everybody long before the publication. And in fact, it had been approved by the FDA based on the data. So the file had gone to the FDA. But it took a long time to get it published because of all the sort of challenges to the concept that you could do this. But I thought the data were pretty straightforward. There certainly was a numeric advantage in favor of using the anthracycline-based regimen that was not statistically significant.
It's in terms of recurrences.
In terms of recurrences. In terms of survival, there was a very little difference of about 1%. But in terms of DFS, it was a 3% difference in favor of the anthracycline. Both of those differences were non-statistically significant. But that came at a cost of a significant, highly statistically significant increase in congestive heart failure, and an also statistically significant increase in subclinical loss that was sustained of cardiac function, which I think is really concerning. And I've talked about this a lot, and it still remains, I think, at least in some corners, a minority opinion. But the reality is I'm told that from reasonably reliable commercial marketing research that between 50 and 60% of the new starts for adjuvant therapy in the U.S. are non-anthracycline, either the TC regimen of docetaxel and cyclophosphamide or the TC and TCH in 006 for HER2-positive breast cancer where carboplatin is the C. So that's pretty interesting to see that kind of change happen this early on. I think that's probably where we're heading, and I think that's the right direction.
You know, we try to keep our pulse on what people are doing, and certainly there's been a lot of TCH used over the last few years, but I think I'm seeing a move back towards anthracyclines, at least in investigators.
I don't know that the investigators ever moved away from them.
Well, I think they did. And, you know, I mean, let me just kind of throw something straight out to you. 50-year-old lady comes in with, you know, 3 positive nodes, otherwise healthy. Most likely, what would you want to recommend to her off study?
Well, we feel pretty comfortable with TCH. And in fact, the node positive argument is, as you know from the 006 study and the published data, where the concept has always been, well, if you have higher risk disease, you need to use the anthracyclines. In fact, with those larger tumors and those tumors that have multiple nodes, even 4 or more, the regimens are identical in terms of the hazard ratios. So there's no difference, not even a numerical difference in favor of the anthracycline. So I'm comfortable with TCH in those patients. But of course, that's been sort of what our mantra has been from the time we showed some of the phase two data where it looked like a pretty effective regimen.
I think Dan Hayes got into that issue in his editorial that I think kind of concluded that both are options. Of course, people always want to know what people actually do in their practices. Let's talk a little bit about some of the new developments. And before we get into the agents, you mentioned all the translational work that your group is doing. And I noticed some of the stuff that's coming out relates to the issue of resistance to trastuzumab and lapatinib for that matter. What have we learned about that?
Well, certainly the pathway that's been implicated in a large degree has been the PI3 kinase pathway, which is why I think BOLERO-1 was run, and there are a lot of trials that are ongoing now looking at a number of different PI3 kinase inhibitors, either pure PI3 kinase inhibitors or the combined inhibitors of the PI3 kinase pathway and mTOR. So I think that those are all going to report out, and we'll see what the data show in terms of HER2 resistance. Other pathways that are being looked at in HER2 resistance are the hormone pathway, interestingly enough. There's some data that there may be a seesaw effect going on, that when you block the peptide growth factor pathways, the hormone growth factor pathways may then begin to take over and drive the tumor. So combined therapies, and I think you know about some of this data, Neil's been around for a while, the concept, combined therapy of both HER2 blockade and hormonal blockade in those dual positive tumors might be more effective than HER2 blockade alone. That's being studied, I think, more correctly than it's been studied in the past with some of the new trials.
That ties into something I wanted to ask you about that came out in the San Antonio meeting 2010, which is the neoadjuvant studies that were presented, HER2 positive studies. And one of the things that there seemed to be some evidence was that maybe the difference in response to chemotrastuzumab was different based on the ER. That hadn't been seen in the adjuvant trials, but in the neoadjuvant studies, it looked like there was a greater response rate in the HER2 positive ER negatives. Do you think that's for real?
Actually, there's been a hint of that even in the adjuvant studies. We'll be putting together some data from 006 that I think show the same thing. So I think you're right. That is a real phenomenon, that the ER-PR negative HER2 positives tend to be more responsive to the HER2 targeting therapies than those that are HER2 positive and ER positive. That is not to say that the HER2 targeting therapies don't work in that latter group, but just that they don't work as effectively as we see in the ER negative group. So I think this idea of combined blockade of the steroid hormone pathway or ancillary pathways that affect it, as well as the HER2 pathway, might be a strategy to go.
So I've been talking with your colleague, another colleague down the hall, Laura Pinter-Brown, about the antibody drug conjugate brentuximab vedotin in lymphoma. A lot of excitement about that, and kind of seems a little bit similar to T-DM1. I know there's a whole bunch of antibody drug conjugates in development. Before you start talking about T-DM1, what do you think about that strategy in general moving forward in cancer research?
I think you're going to see a lot more of that coming. The challenge had been, Neil, and again, you've been at this a while, so you've seen a lot of these things come and go. A lot of the other conjugates had the problem that there was a lot of toxicity associated with them because the cytotoxic, or in the case of radioisotopes, the radioisotope was being unconjugated prematurely before the antibody delivered the payload to the target. I think some of the newer conjugation chemistry has really changed that. And I think some of the molecules that companies have been putting out there really use this new chemistry. And that's what T-DM1 has been based on. And it looks like it's pretty effective. That, as you may know, that DM1 was a drug that never got out of phase one because it was so highly toxic. But when it's linked to trastuzumab, it appears that the safety profile is remarkably good. And none of the systemic effects that never let DM1 out of the phase one setting appear to occur. And in fact, when you look at T-DM1, the things of our standard cytotoxic, it appears that T-DM1 outperforms that in terms of side effect profile, alopecia, cytopenias, etc. The only downside of it is so far thrombocytopenia, none of which has been really limiting. It's been manageable and not had any significant bleeding problems or requiring platelet transfusions. And then the other one is some mild transaminitis, which itself also is quite transient. So right now it looks great, and the conjugate strategy looks very good for not only that, but some of the other lymphoma antibodies against the markers on lymphoma cells. So it's going to be a matter of identifying the right marker, having a good antibody that gets to that marker on the surface, and then having a conjugate strategy where the chemistry doesn't allow your toxin to be disconjugated early.
So where are things now with TDM1? What do we know about it, and what are we going to learn about in the next year or two?
I think the data that has come out already, again, looks very favorable. Compared to the approved trastuzumab docetaxel regimen in metastatic disease, it was, again, numerically superior but not statistically better in terms of response rates in measurable disease patients. But then when you looked at the progression-free survival, there was a dramatic improvement in PFS in those patients who got TDM1 over traditional trastuzumab docetaxel. So I think there's a lot of promise for that. Now, the drug, I think, was being relegated. I don't pretend to have any inside information about this, but I think it was being relegated to the refractory setting in HER2-positive disease. But when that data came out about the PFS being so incredibly different, response rates being the same, a little bit in favor of TDM1, but essentially not statistically different, I think there's been a rethinking of using TDM1 in the adjuvant setting. And then with the combination data that came out at San Antonio of trastuzumab and pertuzumab, you can certainly think about a strategy of TDM1 pertuzumab, which also is being tested now clinically. Preclinically, it looks very good. I'd love to see us get to the point where we could treat patients in the adjuvant setting without the cytotoxics, or dialing back significantly on the amount and the numbers of cytotoxic drugs we use in the adjuvant setting. To think about an adjuvant strategy where women would go through their adjuvant therapy without hair loss, without significant nausea, vomiting, and cytopenias would be remarkable. That would be, I think, the next really big step forward, and we'd love to be involved in trying to make that happen. But I think we're certainly not alone in that.
Now, in terms of non-chemo combinations, another one out there is trastuzumab lapatinib without chemo that's been reported. Where do you see that fitting into non-protocol therapy nowadays?
Before the pertuzumab data, I would think that that was going to be a reasonable strategy as the most effective things we had available to us to use. The challenge is, of course, trastuzumab, in the absence of anthracycline, tends to be a pretty forgiving drug. There's not a lot of side effects you get with it, and certainly nothing that would worry you about adjuvant therapy. Lapatinib can be challenging, given the diarrhea that occurs with it, and many of the patients, I'm told, on the ALTO trial, and certainly was the case on NEO-ALTO, had to be dose-reduced significantly or discontinued because of the effects of the lapatinib, either the diarrhea or the skin rash. That's an on-target effect, so it's going to be hard to get around it. But if pertuzumab trastuzumab gives you similar efficacy, and that's an if, but preliminary data look good, if it gives you similar efficacy without that safety challenge, then I think that'll be a winner.
I'm just kind of curious, in your own practice outside a trial setting, are there situations in metastatic disease where you use trastuzumab lapatinib?
Absolutely. We've been using it for a while outside the trial setting. Since both drugs are approved for metastatic disease, you can get access to both. There's data that shows that trastuzumab beyond progression can be effective, some of the data from Gunther von Minkwitz. And then there's data, clearly, that lapatinib is effective in HER2-progressing disease. So the combination, both are approved, so the combination is something we do use.
Now, you mentioned the ALTO trial, and of course everybody's excited about that in the adjuvant setting, looking at chemo, trastuzumab, lapatinib, but also the lapatinib single agent arm of that was closed.
Yes.
I guess because it wasn't going to be as effective as trastuzumab. What were your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's probably the supposition we all are making, myself included, as to why that arm was closed. The DSMB must have seen the data, and the letter went out saying that if you're on that mono or on the lapatinib arm, you may consider crossover to trastuzumab. Certainly, NEO-ALTO implied that. There was a superiority for the trastuzumab regimen over the lapatinib, and I think that people are taking off on that, that perhaps lapatinib by itself may be less effective than trastuzumab by itself. But it's clear that the combination is superior to either alone, and I suspect that ALTO is going to show the same result. ALTO will also tell us a lot of other, I think, important information, including the relative efficacy of the two drugs in a large study, 8,000 patients, pretty big. It'll tell us the relative safety. So this issue of cardiac dysfunction and congestive heart failure, whether lapatinib is better than trastuzumab or vice versa. And then finally, the really important issue about those brain recurrences, whether or not the lapatinib combo or lapatinib monotherapy arm has less brain recurrences, indicating that maybe that drug's getting access where trastuzumab doesn't into the CNS. So Alto will give us a lot of important answers, I think.
I mean, do you have the sense that maybe there's less anti-tumor activity of lapatinib versus trastuzumab? Do you think they're about the same? Do you think that maybe this is a toxicity issue?
Well, I think there's certainly a safety issue. There's no question that the data seem to imply that. There is an inkling that trastuzumab may be superior in terms of response and efficacy that would give the nod to trastuzumab over lapatinib, but I think Alto will answer that definitively. But yeah, I think that the early data is indicating that the trastuzumab may be more effective.
So I guess, you know, everybody's starting to talk about what's the next generation of adjuvant trials, you know, T-DM1, pertuzumab, but we're also waiting for the second generation of trials to report. You mentioned Alto, but the other big one is your group, the BCRG and NSABP, looking at adding bevacizumab to chemotrastuzumab. And there were some data in that regard, I think it was called the Avril trial, presented at San Antonio. What about this concept of bevacizumab in HER2-positive disease?
Well, there were data a long time ago in the phase 2 setting that you're aware of that really showed that combo could be effective. There was a lot of, again, preclinical information that led us to that strategy. And the Beth trial that you're referring to will answer. Now, the trial's completely enrolled. It's simply awaiting events. We've already had the first look. We haven't, but the DSMB has, that was triggered by 99 events. Now, that's very few events, but we were told to continue follow-up, and nothing was released early on that. I think we'll know before the end of this year, we'll have reached the second hallmark, which is, I believe, more than 150 or 160 events. And we may get a better sense of whether or not the combination is better than trastuzumab alone. If the trial is positive, I think it would once again underscore the thing that marker-selected trials is where we need to be heading in the field. I think almost everyone agrees with that. And this was marker-selected. Here, bevacizumab was being used in a selected population of patients, those that are HER2-positive, because of the fact that the VEGF levels look so much higher in these HER2-positive breast cancer cells in terms of VEGF being produced than they do in HER2-normal cells. That's what was finally worked out in the preclinical data that led to the clinical testing that gave us the early exciting results. So Beth will tell us, the final answer to that. And I hope we'll have some data before the end of this year, certainly by the first quarter of next year.
Now, speaking about bevacizumab, your group again has the so-called Beatrice study looking at adjuvant bevacizumab in patients with triple-negative tumors. Where are we with that right now? And what are your thoughts in general about bevacizumab and breast cancer?
Well, I mean, it's got the well-known challenges that everyone knows about that led to the FDA pulling the drug back out of breast cancer. In that, you know, get this PFS improvement. Certainly the biggest improvement was seen in E2100. There was less improvement in some of the other trials that were looked at subsequently, but still there was an improvement. But then in survival, there was no difference. And when you think about the cost of the drug and the safety, that always becomes a consideration. I think that Beatrice was a reasonable strategy. The trials enrolled, we'll see what we get in terms of the triple negative population. But the strategy was that they may be more responsive to anti-angiogenic therapy than the counterparts. And John Mackey has been effective in being one of the lead investigators on that trial. So we're anxiously awaiting final results from that.
And John gave a great talk at ASCO about the whole concept of anti-angiogenesis. And one of the things that there's been a lot of discussion about, it sort of harkens back to what you were saying in terms of anti-HER therapy and von Mankiewicz, is continuation of bevacizumab on progression or duration of use of bevacizumab. Is there a rebound? And now there's an intriguing press release, and all that is a press release. I guess it'll be presented at ASCO in colon cancer, showing a randomized trial of over 800 patients of a benefit of continuation in colon cancer of Bev on progression. Any thoughts about this concept of duration of anti-angiogenic treatment?
Certainly, you know, when you looked at the C01 data, there was an implication that perhaps the fact that the curve separated early and then came back together might have indicated that more prolonged therapy could have sustained a difference that was meaningful. There's always the worry about rebound that you mentioned, that the compensatory effects that the tumor has, the increase, the up the ante, if you will, to increase the VEGF level so that when you take VEGF blockade away, the disease comes really roaring back, given the fact that there's a real positive pro-angiogenic feed. It'll be interesting to see what the data come out at ASCO from the press release you mentioned, you're right, to see if that would be the effect. But the big difference between bevacizumab and trastuzumab is that bevacizumab does have safety concerns that we hadn't really seen with trastuzumab in terms of continued therapy. If a patient doesn't have the cardiac event, and we know that using a non-anthracycline regimen can almost completely take that away, there really is no other significant side effects of trastuzumab. Whereas with Bev, there are some challenges. Certainly the hypertension, the worry about perforations, things like that. There's small numbers of patients who experience this, but it's real.
What about the use of anti-HER2 TKIs beyond lapatinib? The two I've heard about in clinical development are neratinib and afatinib.
Well, neratinib is an active anti-HER2 agent, but I think it had the same challenge, if not more so, than lapatinib did with some of the GI toxicity, which I think will limit its use ultimately in the adjuvant setting. I know there are people who disagree with that, but that's my opinion of what the data show that I've seen. I think afatinib is going through its testing right now, and assuming it doesn't have a similar significant tox profile and has equal or better efficacy than we have in the approved agent lapatinib, then I think that's a drug that might have some utility. Some of these irreversible binders to the kinase may be better than the reversible binders. That's certainly what the early data is showing with the Pfizer PanHER compound and with afatinib. So I think the ultimate jury is the clinical trial data, and that jury's still out, but those trials are being accrued and we'll know.
One final question. I was curious about your perception of what's happened over the last couple of years as regard research on PARP inhibitors, including the disappointing results with the agent eniparib and new agents under study, including vilaparib and olaparib.
My sense is that the PARP inhibitor story has been extremely cyclic in terms of it went through a period where there was enormous excitement, and then there was a PARP inhibitor that was tested in the clinic that Joyce O'Shaughnessy reported on phase 2 data at ASCO that looked extremely exciting that didn't pan out in phase 3. But in retrospect, even in the phase 2, people who were knowledgeable about PARP inhibitors were saying that among the PARP inhibitors, this was the least effective at inhibiting PARP. And it turns out, as more data have come in, I think even the companies that work with the drug are now comfortable with the fact that this is not a very effective PARP inhibitor. But the phase 3 data, after an enormous amount of excitement, I think really gave the field sort of a black eye, if you want, for saying that PARP inhibition may not work. And I think for sure the jury's still out on that. In order for it to work, A, you have to have a PARP inhibitor that's fairly potent, and B, you have to be able to select the patient population in which you think it might work. And so far, that's been restricted to the BRCAs. Everybody else who's got a PARP inhibitor have played in that sort of safe turf in breast cancer. In ovarian cancer, it appears that there may be more activity, and some of the data with olaparib look pretty promising in ovarian cancer in those patients who are platinum responsive. So that shows that the strategy works. Now the question is finding the right breast cancer patients. Certainly BRCA mutants will be there, but we know that it's going to go beyond that and go in with a good PARP inhibitor and try to identify a marker or markers that will identify the responsive population. And I think we'll have another very exciting pathway to hit with some good drugs.
Of course, that ovarian data you mentioned was so exciting was just PARP inhibition by itself, but another strategy has been combining it, particularly with cytotoxics. Which strategy, or do you think both, is where we're heading?
I think the fact that the monotherapy, as you pointed out, Neil, works is really concept proof that this pathway is active and operating in these cancers, and when you inhibit it, you can have an effect. The idea of a synthetic lethality, if you will, in other words, adding the PARP inhibition to an insult on the DNA, so you induce the damage and it can't repair, I think will give us even more mileage. So my sense is it'll probably be used perhaps more so in breast and ovary where you're seeing this monotherapy result. But I would imagine you'd also see that kind of work going on in ovary cancer. The big challenge is, of course, what are you going to do to the DNA pathways in normal cells, in particular in the marrow, and will you enhance cytopenias? And I think, again, we tend to get locked into a way of thinking about things, and you and I have talked several times, that the field keeps doing things in many respects the same way. So we keep our cytotoxic doses at the full dose and add the PARP inhibitor on top. We may not need to do that. What they've done then is when they see toxicities, dial back on the PARP inhibitor. It might be the right way to go, and we've got preclinical data that seems to support this, that keep the PARP level at the highest and dial back on the cytotoxic, so you still induce damage, but in the normal cells, there are enough intact repair pathways that you can circumvent the toxicity. So there are a couple of ways to skin the cat here.